So often, especially as women, we're told to be quiet, ignore our intuition, or all the other sorts of things, or we go to a doctor and they deny our symptoms. And one of my messages here is, women and men, but especially women, your intuition is a gift inside of you that will guide you to the right answers and guide you to the right people and guide you to the right relationships and the right healing plans. And if you start to get back in touch with that, and you can only really get in touch with that if you love and appreciate yourself. So at the core of healing is this self-love and self-compassion and really trusting that voice inside of you that says something's not right. And then finding an advocate or support, family, friends, prayer, religion, not religion, whatever kind of thing, meaning or purpose, that gives you that sense of greater purpose and gives you that sense of understanding. And I feel like that's more important than any supplement, any IV, any hyperbaric chamber, is that really trusting our intuition, following it, letting us guide us, and loving ourselves at the root level. Those cores are more powerful than any pill.
Dr. Jill Carnahan is your functional medicine expert. She's duly board certified and is the founder and medical director of Faltration Functional Medicine. As a survivor of breast cancer, Crohn's disease, and toxic mold illness, she brings a unique perspective to treating patients. She specializes in searching for the underlying cause of illness through cutting-edge lab testing and personalized medicine protocols. Jill is also the author of a best-selling book, Unexpected: Finding Resilience Through Functional Medicine, Science, and Faith. It's a powerful perspective memoir that will have you laughing, crying with her on her journey, leaving you with key resources you need to achieve optimal health and wellness. She's also the executive producer, film writer, and featured in a new documentary about her journey overcoming illness called Doctor/Patient. Dr. Jill Carnahan, I am so excited to have you on Take Back Your Health podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here again with you.
I know. We go way, way back. And so actually, as you and I were talking, I really have never heard your story about your health path and how you got into functional medicine. I mean, you're known as the queen of mold, unfortunately, because I know you help so many people. But let's just start by talking about your background and how you found your way to functional medicine and your health journey, please.
Sure. It's so interesting because I didn't really know that I was a healer. But what happens to those of us who are kind of called to that healing profession is we end up going through some of our own issues. And I think it's part of, like, back then I didn't know, and I'll tell you in just a second the exact story. But when these things started to hit, you know, you're first like, what in the world? What's happening? But now looking back, I couldn't ask for a better story because it's given me so much depth and insight and understanding to patients. And literally, I've been through it all. So I grew up on a farm in central Illinois, one of five children. My mother was a retired nurse to raise the family. Grew up in a really idyllic place. I mean, we had a, you know, half acre garden. So that was part of my chores, was to go out and pick raspberries or pick peas or plant potatoes or do things like that. So very like nurturing with the earth. We had an orchard with apples and did apple cider in the fall. So lots of like typical farm kind of activities. Grew up with a really strong German work ethic, which has been a great asset, but also something I've had to really unlearn. And all that to say, really great childhood. But unbeknownst to me, there was a lot of toxicity. So of course, on the farm in the 70s and 80s, there was chemicals, yes, pesticides, endocrine disruptors. And Roundup didn't come along for several, maybe a decade later, but it still was, you know, in my teens, at least present. All that to say, I was in medical school. So I decided to become a doctor. And no one else in my family had done medicine except for nursing. So it's kind of a different thing. In fact, I remember even applying to schools. I applied at like acupuncture and chiropractic and all these other allied health professions because we had grown up in a much more holistic mindset. And we went to doctors. It wasn't like we were, you know, avoidant of the medical system, but we knew that there was ways to heal our bodies with food or hot tea or chicken soup or, you know, things before we would go see the doctor right away. So my mentality was very holistic from the beginning. A lot of people think that it was after the breast cancer that I became more holistic minded, but it was there from the core, like the farm girl in me and the kind of holistic nurture. But 25 years old, I'm in my third year of medical school. I'm literally in the surgical rotation, which if you remember, we get taught breast exams because breast cancer, breast surgery is a big deal for surgeons. And I remember just, you know, I was just a few weeks before my 25th birthday, reaching over to my left breast and doing a breast exam, first time ever, not even thinking twice about it. But there was something thick, just a little bit of a, like a half inch by maybe an inch thickening. It wasn't even a lump. I wouldn't have said it. I was like, I would have totally ignored it. But my husband at the time was very insistent, you know, get something checked out, ended up having mammogram, ultrasound. And to describe in the book, sitting there, you know, when you're in medical school, everything is a teaching opportunity. So literally as the patient, I went back to the radiologist room to look at the films, the mammogram, the ultrasound with him so I could learn. And I will never forget that moment, Amy, because I looked over at him and saw like the kind of terror in his eyes, like there was something not right. And yet here I was a 24, barely, you know, 25-year-old student. And I remember him saying, well, Jill, if you were 55 years old, this is the classical findings of calcifications of ductal carcinoma. But you're 25, and so the likelihood's very low, but you should get a biopsy. Like, you know, he did said the right thing. But I knew at that moment, like intuitively, talk about intuition, I knew I was like, there is something not right. I went ahead, had biopsy, all that, and I got a diagnosis of invasive, very aggressive breast cancer at 25 years old. And just to put it in perspective for those of you listening, sadly, the incidence of breast cancer is so increasing every year, and the incidence of women under 40 is also increasing. But in 2001, when I was diagnosed at Loyola University in Chicago, one of the major medical institutes in the Midwest, I was the youngest that had ever been diagnosed in that institute.
Wow. I mean, just I'll pause right there. Our stories, though I haven't been through cancer, are just so similar with the holistic upbringing. You know, I had moved out to Seattle to go to Bastyr to maybe be a naturopathic doctor, you know, and then my diagnosis of autoimmunity and Graves disease, you know, but I had already gone into medical school to sort of do what we both now do. Wow. Okay. So what did you do at that moment? I mean, since you already had this holistic view, was your first thought, I'm going to go back to my roots and do something holistic? Was it, I've just got to put my hands in faith into conventional medicine? I mean, what were you doing at that moment?
Right. This is so relevant to anyone out there who's ever struggled with a new diagnosis or a life-threatening illness or a friend or family member, because two things. Number one, deep in my intuition was, I can overcome this. I can do no matter what, even though the prognosis was grim and I was facing my life-threatening. I didn't know at that moment if I had 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years. So now you look back, it's 20 plus years and I'm healthy and thriving. But at that moment, you don't know. And then second, I wanted to do something holistic, but I was facing this life-threatening illness. And everyone in the community was like, no, you need surgery, you need radiation, you need chemotherapy. And everyone who met for the case, they literally had an M&M morbidity mortality case, you know, how the docs got together, the residents. And I was the subject. And they said, what are we going to do with Jill? Because this is complex. She's young. It's very aggressive. And they basically threw everything they could at it as far as the chemo, a 3-drug chemotherapy, as much as they could possibly do before my heart would stop beating, and then radiation and surgery. But what I did was that stubborn German in me came out and I was like, wait a second, isn't there more? What can I do? So I went to the library and studied for literally a couple of weeks of what's the best statistics on this? What do I do? And I literally did everything different. Number one, there was a heart toxic drug that I chose to have a different one that was less heart toxic that was never used hardly. And I just said, I want this drug instead of the classical one. Oh, with my radiation, I went to have a brand new experimental procedure where they basically radiated the breast from the inside out, from the tumor site out. Now it's more common, but at the time it was totally unheard of because that external beam radiation would hit my heart on the left side. So I created this whole plan and everybody was supportive, which was amazing. I had a team of oncologists. And then what I did is, this is the holistic part of me. I had a pastor, I had a prayer warriors, I had nutritional supplements. I saw a naturopath. I had just so many things in the alternative at that time, things that were surrounding me. And I think the most important was a family and friends that like loved me and lifted me up. And when I was so sick and I couldn't get out of bed and I could barely move, I had this incredible support network that was there with me.
Did you do, I mean, what we certainly would have called alternative back then, and some would still say now, like acupuncture, hyperbarics, saunas? I mean, was there anything else that you added besides the nutrition? Sounds like prayer, community. You have a whole book on, you know, you have a whole book on this. We're going to get into this later. So prayer, community, family, friends, and nutrition and supplements, and then, of course, the regular regimen. Were there other things that you added as well?
Looking back, I would have done hyperbaric and IV and maybe peptides and all these kinds of things I know now. But no, it was really simple. I did have a really good naturopath. And the place where I got chemo was actually like, it was very conventional chemo, but the way they did it, they divided it into 2 days. They did some timing of the therapy so that it was less toxic. There was a bunch of things, and there was a naturopath on staff that allowed me to do. So it was mostly nutrition. I did change my diet dramatically, and that was actually shortly after the breast cancer when I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease.
Do you think that the Crohn's disease, I mean, of course, you'll probably never know, but in your heart of hearts, do you believe that that is perhaps a side effect of everything that you went through with the chemotherapy and the radiation?
Yeah. So now it all makes so much more sense because some of those drugs, one is Cytoxan, cyclophosphamide. It is known in the literature to induce leaky gut as one of its mechanisms. It basically dumps that immune contents into the bloodstream and creates this immune activation, which is great for cancer. Not so great for autoimmunity, right? Like you and I know this. So it's the exact opposite of what you want for autoimmunity, but exactly what you want for an aggressive system that's fighting cancer. So if in hindsight, number one, I was celiac disease, didn't know it. So I had silent celiac at 14 because I had low B12, low zinc, again, not knowing it, low stomach acid. I didn't like meat. So it wasn't like I had any ethical things. I grew up on a farm with steak and potatoes, kind of a family. But at 14, I was this bizarre kiddo because I was like, no more meat for me.
I did the same thing. 14, gave up meat. 27 years, I didn't eat meat. Wow. I've known you for so long and I didn't realize some of these, you know, commonalities in us.
And then looking back, it wasn't this that I did. I'd never liked meat. It didn't feel good to me. But right now I'm like, oh, I was zinc deficient. I was hypochlorhydric. I was low stomach acid, couldn't break down meat well. And then I was severely B12 deficient and I was silent celiac. So I did, at the time, didn't know it was the worst thing I could possibly done. I became a carbitarian because on the farm, I didn't know how to be a healthy vegetarian. So I gravitated towards carbs and gluten-rich foods and more sugary kinds of stuff. Soy, like processed soy, just terrible kinds of stuff. And I thought it was healthy. And then when I was diagnosed with breast cancer a decade later, I realized, oh, this diet is not so good. And what started to happen was after the breast cancer diagnosis, I got through 9 months of therapy. I was so sick. My gut was destroyed by the chemo. And I just assumed it was part of the chemo side effects. My gut was terrible. I was having a weight loss, gas and bloating, nausea, bleeding. But what happened was 6 months later, I'm in the ER. I pass out cold, end up in the hospital for emergency surgery for an abscess. And the surgeon told me the next day, Julie, you have Crohn's disease. So the big picture is I believe that the chemo induced a leaky gut with an already pre-celiac, silent celiac composition with the wrong diet, all this gluten antigens and inflammation, then the leaky gut from the chemotherapy. And then I had bacterial and fungal overgrowth. And I had this gene called NOD2, which is really high risk for Crohn's. And all that means is my genetics mean that if I get this bacterial dumping from the gut to the immune system, I have an overreactive gut lining immune system that will cause the damage from Crohn's. So it was the perfect storm. And would I have gotten Crohn's had I not had the chemo? I think eventually, had I not changed my diet, I probably would have. And then celiac was in the mix too. So all this to say, when I got the diagnosis of Crohn's, I was like, okay, what in the world is going on? Once again, being the detective you and I are, I dove deep and said, what is going on with this? How could it be related? The doc that saw me said, Jill, diet has nothing to do with it. And that's again where the intuition kicked in. I was like, no way does diet have nothing to do with it. And I did not know anything about nutrition as a third-year medical student.
Sorry to interrupt. Where you were in your medical school path or had you become a doctor? So you were still a medical student at this point. Okay.
Yeah, I had just ended my third year with a diagnosis, took 9 months off for therapy. So went back to finish my fourth year. And it was in the like three, four months into that where I was diagnosed with Crohn's and taken, you know, to the sidelines again. And that's where I started learning. Because as you know, and I'll just speak to your listeners, in medical school, the basic nutrition is 6 weeks of TPN. That's IV nutrition for surgical patients. That's it. We do not learn the value of whole foods and all the kind of stuff that we preach and practice. So I didn't know anything. And even though the doc, you know, we go to our authority, we think the docs know what they're doing, even for you and I. And the truth is, like, there's this deep intuition for a patient that I love to empower because deep down, you know, if someone says, oh, everything looks normal, but you don't feel well. Or, you know, if the doc told me, Jill, diet has nothing to do with Crohn's. I was like, no way. So there's this deep intuition that we can sometimes follow that leads us to healing, even if we don't have a medical background.
Absolutely. I mean, I always would tell my patients that if you sense that something's wrong with you and you're going to doctor after doctor, you've got to continue to look. I mean, I too was in a different kind of way brushed off by my doctor. Mine came out the beginning of my second year of medical school, and I was having heart palpitations and tremors and weight loss and insomnia. And I went to the doctor and she immediately just said, oh, you're a second year medical student. You think you have everything that you're learning about? I said, no. I mean, my mother passed away in 4 months from pancreatic cancer. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the middle of nowhere and had to adjust all that. I have never responded to stress this way. I mean, there is something really going on with me. And then, of course, you know, she did a full workup and I had Graves' disease. So, you know, even those of us in the medical community that are taken more seriously, many of these things happen to women and we are brushed off as females. I mean, you experienced it. I experienced it. I mean, I know you probably have thousands of patients as I did that experienced it every day.
Yeah. And I love speaking to this in an audience like yours, because it's so important if you're listening out there and you're like, something's not right. I'm waking up with headaches or joint pain, or you name the hundreds of other cognitive issues. You know, in your heart, something isn't quite right. And you go to your doctor and very frequently your routine blood tests are normal. And literally many times it's, well, maybe you need an antidepressant. Now, there's nothing wrong with antidepressants. I prescribe them. I use them. There's a real thing called depression. But if you just wake up with headaches in the morning or your cognition is declining, that doesn't necessarily mean you're depressed. And I just feel so strongly about getting that message out to be your own ally and to find someone who will be your voice and to really look deeply like you and Dr. Myers or myself, because it's so critical.
In your practice, I mean, is cancer something that you see and advise on?
I do. I would say I'm much more gut and hormone and all of that autoimmune related, but absolutely. What I realize is in our conventional system, there is a big political issue about alternatives. And yet I don't even like that word, but in the conventional world, we could say alternatives to like chemo and conventional therapy because it's such a big money issue. And there's no, I have no agenda here saying any of this, but the truth is there's such a large amount of money being made on drugs for cancer and surgeries and procedures that it is really hard to get the truth out about nutrition and the value there. And there's been a lot of like medical boards and things that have cracked down on doctors that are talking about alternatives to conventional therapy. So what I've done is always say, you need an oncologist. You need someone who's an expert, whether it's integrative or regular conventional. I will work alongside you. I will help your body nutritionally recover. I will support you. I'm not your oncologist. I'm not treating your cancer. But there's colleagues like Nasha Winters and Shalise Pratt and some of those other people out there that are literally like naturopathic doctors and others that they are on the front lines giving alternatives to conventional treatment. Kudos to them. I haven't gone there, but I think it's important.
You mentioned that you know through the literature, maybe through your clinic, that there is a dramatic rise in particularly breast cancer. And I think all types of breast cancer. In fact, I have a half sister who is just turned 30 and was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer spread to the lymph nodes. So I can attest in my own family of seeing that with, you know, absolutely no history on either sides of the family. Where is this statistic, or why are you saying that? And what do you think, I'm sure it's multifactorial, but what are your thoughts on what the reasons for this spike is?
Well, I just saw, you know, Medscape's this very public medical place that disseminates information for doctors is real common, just literally last week article on the surprising dramatic rise since 2016 in women under 40. Like it was just, you saw this line where it's just like going along and then boom, it just shoots up. And the docs were trying to say, and again, from a conventional perspective, they kind of don't have a clue, to be honest. But from you and I's perspective, to me, the elephant in the room is environmental toxic load. Now, mold's in that bucket, but there's a lot of other chemicals out there that are exponentially increasing every year, including electromagnetic frequency. Like the density of radiation affects us when we put our phones on our, especially we carry it in our pocket, breast pocket, or somewhere near our breast. I mean, literally, there's been studies that show the pattern of that radiation on the breast, right? You've seen that too. So I think the exponential increase in environmental toxic load and our inability to kid. So we kind of have this like bailing of the bucket analogy, right? Like our bucket is our capacity to detox. And as the water level fills up, I can just see it, you know, rising above your eyes and then spilling over your head. The top three things that we see are neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, autoimmunity, which is your specialty and mine too, and then cancer. And so those three things I think are exponentially rising because our buckets are all filling up. And I feel like probably 2010, 2016, somewhere in that range, we've started to really, on the majority of us, lose the capacity to keep that water level at a tolerable limit, which is toxic load.
And have you seen in your practice, either, certainly I know there is with autoimmunity, but do you have any experience with cancer with either having had COVID as an infection or the COVID vaccine? I know it's definitely dysregulating the immune system, and there's many reports of increased autoimmunity after the infection and also after the vaccine. I just didn't know if you knew anything regarding cancer. When my sister was diagnosed, I tried to research it, but as you know, so much is being buried and filtered, and you know, virtually everything that came up was simply, if you have breast cancer, go get your vaccine. I did find one study by a gentleman showing that he has seen, I don't remember the physician's name, but an incredible amount of just very rare cancers that normally are either happening in a much older population, happening much younger, or just an exponential increase in the number of these cancers that he related back to, you know, both the infection as well as the vaccination.
Yeah. So what I saw is this pattern, and I think it plays true since, like you said, the pandemic. Number one, there is B cell activation. B cells are the ones that make autoantibodies and antibodies, so there is an absolute increase in autoimmunity. Number two, T cells, which fight viruses and cancer. So this T cell exhaustion is actually the term they use in the literature, which I think is kind of funny because it's not really a medical or technical term, but we can all imagine these T cells are like, oh, I can't keep up anymore. And we see it all the time. In fact, now I'm starting to view COVID and the sequelae after 2-3 months, almost every single person, as an immunocompromised state. So what happens when we're immunocompromised? Old infections, like say we had a tick bite when we're 12, we're fine, Lyme will pop up. Or Epstein-Barr, we got sore throat mono when we were 19 in college, and then that pops up and causes a exhaustion and fatigue. Or the third thing, which is what you just mentioned, either a cancer that was in remission comes back to haunt us, or a new cancer. And like you said, there is no doubt the statistics are showing the aggressiveness of the types of cancer. The young, you know, the age of the people that are getting it is part of that. So T cell exhaustion, B cell activation, and then cortisol is often dramatically affected. And I think that's part of the post fatigue, long COVID for some people. We see these really flatline cortisols in some people after COVID.
I personally, after COVID, I did fine during the infection, but I had what I would call severe lingering fatigue that I hadn't had since, you know, post medical school. Post, you know, I had my thyroid ablated, and I definitely had chronic fatigue that I was able to resolve through functional medicine. But I had this very significant fatigue, and I was getting worried I might get long COVID. And then I don't know if you're using this in your clinic, but I have a hyperbarics machine. So I got in that, and a couple of sessions, it completely resolved, which was, and I've now read a number of studies using hyperbaric with long COVID and fatigue. So I'm wondering if perhaps, you know, I have a history of Epstein-Barr, if that had been reactivated or, you know, what had happened.
I experienced the same. And it was literally like the last episode, April of last year, which was the most mild, like it was just a cold. It was such a mild illness. But I probably for 6 months had issues with POTS, dysautonomia, mast cell activation and fatigue, which is super common. I think that one of the biggest things we're seeing is that COVID damages the endothelium. This is the lining of the vessels everywhere in your body. So it can produce all kinds of effects, cognitive or otherwise. And like you said, if those T cells are exhausted and you have had Epstein-Barr, which is like 95% of the population above 20, that can reactivate and cause a really significant fatigue for several months.
And how are you supporting people? How did you support yourself during that 6 months? And how are you supporting your patients post-COVID that are having lingering fatigue, POTS, mast cell, immune activation?
Yeah, so I actually will check the cytokine labs and kind of see, first of all, is this an endothelial issue? I'd say 80% of the patients that have those symptoms show up with like VEGF and SLC40 and some of these markers that are literally endothelial lining markers that are abnormal. If that's the case, I'm doing something that will chew up fibrin because they're making more fibrin. That would be like Belug, serapeptase, natokinase. Sometimes even natural blood thinners like pycnogenol or nitric oxide precursors or even baby aspirin in some of these patients, like something like that. Now, interesting, you mentioned hyperbaric helped you. So hyperbaric has been known to increase nitric oxide, which opens a blood vessel. So I wonder, it could be definitely like putting Epstein-Barr into remission for someone like you, or maybe it's actually just improving endothelial function. And if you can imagine, blood flow is so crucial to every single thing we do and every single symptom that we might have, that I find is usually a core. So the blood thinners, if needed naturally, the things that chew up fibrin, and then just adrenal support and making sure that the endocrine system, the thyroid, the hormones, the adrenals are okay. And if it is a viral, I'll check viral titers like Epstein-Barr, CMV, HSV, all of those. And then I'll do antiviral herbal tinctures, or once in a while, even prescription antivirals.
Yeah, I started smiling when you were saying that. I remember you sent me your lab slip and I ordered all those markers on myself. So I do think that it's just in Santa Fe, we're at 7,500 feet. And so hyperbarics in general helps me there, right? Because just getting less oxygen. Well, let's move on to another area that unfortunately both you and I are well too versed in, which is mold illness. Would you like to first share your story about that? And then we can kind of get into causes and what to do if you are exposed to toxic molds.
Sure. Yeah. Again, this is one of those things where I just became the guinea pig my whole life. And in 2013, there was a massive flood in Boulder, like they call it the 1,000-year flood, epidemic proportions, and kept half the city underwater. So my office was flooded. I didn't really think much of it. But about 9 months later, I started having shortness of breath, cognitive issues, skin rashes, you name it. I was getting pretty sick. I did not know what was going on, but I had a suspicion that something in my environment could be it. And as you so well know, and we both know, and with patients, very often there's a little bit of denial, because if it really is mold, oh my gosh, it's a lot to deal with. And I feel like it's so core to our safety in our home or workplace. Like it's our home should be the place where we're safe and there's no attack. And then now we know even the chemical inhalation of mold through the limbic system can actually activate that separately from any anxiety we have. So just the chemical smell can activate our limbic system. So there's always this component of kind of like, ooh, what's going on? So I ended up finding out there was mold in the basement. And in hindsight, it's hilarious. I didn't know anything about mold. There was a crawl space right under my office that was unfinished and had standing water. Two levels down, there was bulk stachybotrys growing in a damp basement that was unfinished. And then my office, which was the second floor, the contractor had put down beautiful new bamboo flooring. And instead of taking out the old carpet, he just put it right over the carpet. And of course, I didn't know any better. It's like 20-year-old. I know. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine? Oh my God.
Right? Like how? I look back and I didn't have a clue, right? I just trusted. Like I'm horrified, because that clearly there was probably already some issues there, and then it only got worse. And so every single step was puffing up those mycotoxins and mold from the carpet below.
Wow. And so how did you figure it out? And then what did you do from there?
Yeah, well, back then, that was the early days of mycotoxin testing. We only had about one lab, and I went ahead and did it, and I did have positive trichosanthines, which is the worst kind of mycotoxins from black mold. And then we found bulk stachybotrys from samples in the basement. I'll never forget, Amy, because I didn't know any better. I went down with the inspector, no mask, no gloves. I'm in my like dress from work and like looked poking around at the mold that turned out to be stachybotrys in the basement. Like literally like with a, you know, I'm like, oh my goodness, I had no idea. But that was, so it was clear that there was mold in the basement. There was mycotoxins in my urine, and that's all I needed. I literally didn't set foot in my office after that. I let everything, I sold everything I owned, started a new, I mean, just moved everything over. And what's funny, and you'll get this too, I took my paper charts. And that was the one thing that kind of got me sick, because that paper held the mycotoxins until I scanned those in. I was still having symptoms in the new office.
I am familiar with that. Paper, books, they can be really the worst holders of that, so to speak. I mean, I can't even go in a used bookstore, but the only books, frankly, that I own are ones that people send me, you know, like yourself. I have a copy of your book. But I just don't even buy books now, because, you know, I frankly am always kind of living in this fear, like, is it going to happen to me again? And what am I going to have to get rid of? Now, my child has books, and of course, I have books for her. But I pretty much read things online now, or, you know, get a Kindle or something, so that I'm not even having to deal with books. So I know when I moved offices, I held all my medical records. Well, I eventually got a electronic medical records, but this was all before that was really widely available or required of us. And so I too had some medical charts that just went into a storage unit, and it's now past the 10 years last year. So I was able to finally get rid of those. Yes. I mean, of course, we scanned in all the active people, not me, but someone else did. Now, so you left everything behind and went to a new office besides your medical records. So that is generally what I advise people as well, right? You know, just to leave your home or leave your office and leave it all behind. And as you mentioned, it is so difficult for some people. I mean, obviously you and I have the advantage, so to speak, of seeing lots of patients, knowing how sick people can get. And so probably what it sounds like from your story, it was a pretty no-brainer to just up and leave, and you didn't think anything of it, as I have done myself several times. Now, how do you convince your patients that they really need to leave and to let those items go?
So this is the hard thing, right? And this is where, like, I always understand if they're a little bit in denial. I never forget a husband and wife that I had high suspicions from lab testing, from symptoms that in their master bath, in their bedroom, there was a massive mold issue. They were so in denial no matter what data I gave them. And finally, literally 2 years later, they came into the office. They're like, Dr. Jill, you were right. We remodeled our bathroom. We found massive black mold under the seat in the shower that wasn't properly installed. And here, if we would have listened to you 2 years ago, you know? And it's funny because even my staff, we joke about this. My accuracy of diagnosing mold and telling a patient that there probably is an issue, it's 100%, Amy. I've never been in it. I'm not bragging. It's just you and I know this, right? I'm not wrong because I look at the data. I know how it works. But what you're talking about, and if you're listening out there and you're dealing with mold, this is overwhelming. And what I want to clarify is Amy and I are saying, if it's possible financially to leave and to get rid of especially porous materials, it is the best, period. However, that can incite panic in and of itself. So there's always a conversation. And the biggest thing is, if you have like a desk that's varnished or you have even leather furniture, there are things that can carefully be cleaned and taken with you. Even electronics or your air filters, you can replace those, you can wipe them down, you can wash them, you can blow the air. Like there's ways. Books and paper and mementos like scrapbooks, I feel like are incredibly hard. And if someone has trouble like in the midst of the trauma of dealing with mold, I say put them in plastic storage bins, seal those bins up, put them in your garage or a storage unit away from your residence, get well, and then go back and open that bin. And I promise you, first of all, you're likely to react horribly. I still have a storage unit here in my condo from stuff that I had had before in a house that was moldy, and I can't go in there for more than 5 minutes. Someday I'll have to hire someone to go through that stuff, but for now, it's just away from me. And I know it's moldy, right? But there are things people have that are mementos or, you know, they don't want to get rid of heirlooms, but rugs, things that are not able to be cleaned, things that are paper, don't mess around. Your health is too valuable.
So I too have many of those stories of people, well, most people, if they came to see me, do take the advice. But of course, they're the ones that just are in denial. And then you get the phone call or the letter or something a couple years later that, God, if I'd only listened then, you know, I would have been further on my health journey. I can feel it on people. I mean, if it's bad enough, I can. So, I mean, I've literally just said, I don't even need a lab test. I mean, I'm sure you need one before you move from your house and get rid of all your belongings, but I'm telling you what your problem is. A friend of mine here told me in Austin that I went in her house and I was like, it's there, there, it's there. She opened it up and that's where it all was. So I feel you with the blessing and the curse of, you know, being able to be so sensitive to be able to tell. And yes, I mean, I have a storage unit here. My mother was an artist and I have her paintings that I can't tolerate, but I also don't want to throw away. And so I spend money every year to just store these, hoping, you know, I don't know what I'm thinking. I'm going to give them to my child, but then I won't be able to go into her house if they're hanging up. So who knows, but I can't get rid of them. And everything that you said, I 100% agree with in terms of, you know, just depending on where you are. I know how sensitive I am, so I need to get rid of everything when it happens. You know, it was very interesting. I've gone through it alone. I've gone through it with a husband, and then I've now gone through it with a child. And I can just tell you, going through it with a child brings it to such another level. I mean, when it happened to me there, of course, all I cared about was our health and safety. But, you know, I don't care a thing about any of my things. But she, you know, she's at the time was 5. I mean, she didn't understand where her dolls or her stuffed animals were. And so I had this different level of protection. And I don't even know how to describe it, but just protection of like, I did not want this to be part of her story, of her childhood trauma of having to, you know, get rid of all of her things. So I wore a hazmat suit and personally washed a number of her things in order to try to, I mean, I actually might go into tears, so I'll stop talking about it, but to personally wash some very sentimental things of hers that, you know, I knew would be traumatic if we had to get rid of. And so I can definitely say going through this, it's much easier to do it as a single person than it is, you know, with lots of other people, loved ones in your life. So besides leaving and getting rid of your belongings, what are your next steps in helping somebody recover from mold illness?
Well, just first of all, I love that you shared that because I know people out there, if they've experienced this or they follow you, that a lot of them do have these experiences. And I kind of want to just pause for 1 second because this is hard. Yeah. It is freaking, I think, some of the hardest stuff. And what you mentioned there is you had a supportive spouse, it sounds like. But very frequently, someone who's going through this, male or female, has a spouse or partner or someone in their life that just thinks they're crazy. And I kind of just wanted to pause and speak to that because it is, I think it's extra hard when you're trying to advocate for yourself. And you know, and I know when we don't feel well, there's like we're mold dogs, right? Like we go into a place and we know we're like, we walk right back out of it, somewhere we can leave. And because we know we're confident in our ability to tell, but so often someone suffering is like, oh, I think there's something wrong. And then everyone around them like, no, you're crazy. And they start to deny their own self. And I think that is the biggest crime with this, is that basically suppression of their own intuition because they know something's wrong and everybody else is telling them they're crazy. And they start to feel like they're crazy because it's such a weird thing. It's invisible, right? So I just wanted to mention that because I think it's so, so critical. If you're suffering out there and you're listening or you've been through this, find someone who's your advocate, who believes in you and who says, oh my gosh, you don't feel well, let's leave. Like, because that is actually part of the healing. That is part of the healing, to have someone there with you to advocate for your needs instead of you trying to advocate and think that you're crazy. But what else can you do?
That was right. And I mean, I certainly don't want to make generalizations, but most of my clinic was made up of patients that were women. I mean, I specialize in autoimmunity. It affects women more than men. You know, I was thinking, you know, I don't know if mold and having the genes, the SNPs to not clear mycotoxins affects women more than men. Do you know? Or maybe it's just that they're getting this secondary autoimmunity. Yeah. Well, you know,
because autoimmunity is really 4 times more common in women. So right. I would guess.
Right. And then molds can be an underlying cause of that. But again, I don't want to make generalizations, but I saw in my clinic frequently that it was the wife that was coming. And, you know, it was the husband that generally was the primary breadwinner. And they often, like my husband, didn't have symptoms, right? So the husband is the primary breadwinner and they don't have the symptoms. And then the wife is coming in saying, we need to leave. And not only do we need to leave our home, we need to get rid of everything we own. And so you can't take the finances of this out of it. It's extremely expensive when this happens to you. And so, you know, that also would become a struggle between these couples as well was, you know, not only was the husband not feeling it and then, perhaps saying that his wife or partner is crazy, but, you know, was this whole financial component as well that sometimes the women didn't have the ability to just say, well, forget it, I'm leaving, because, you know, they might be a stay-at-home mom or something of the effect. So it was another dynamic I often saw.
Because it's so hard. I think that's one of the hardest parts. So you asked what we can do about it. So at the core, what we're doing is we need to. So when we get inhalation, these mycotoxins, which are the toxins produced by mold. So usually the spores, granted, they can cause an allergic reaction, but they're not going into our bloodstream. It's the toxins the mold is producing that can go right through a wall, right through a floor, into our lungs. And these are particulate matter less than 2.5, which means the size of it goes right through our alveoli into our blood, do not pass go, doesn't need transport. And so within seconds of inhaling mycotoxins from a moldy environment, they go into our blood circulates around, and they get stored in tissues. So you get out of the house, what you need to do is get these mold mycotoxins out of your tissues into the blood, filtered by the kidneys and the liver, and then out of your body. And that's the process that we both help patients get through to heal and even our own selves. And it can take months. People often ask me time frame. I'd say 6 to 18 months is a pretty average, 18 months being maybe more common. It's just slow and steady. So what do? We take liver and emphasize the biotoxin, biotransformation. And we need more glutathione. Glutathione is our master antioxidant detoxification helper. And you can either take that, get it IV, inhale it, nebulize it. There's all kinds of ways you can get glutathione in. Or if you can't tolerate it, you can do precursors like glutamine, glycine, N-acetylcysteine, all these other things that help. That glutathione will help to mobilize these toxins. And then your liver can actually take that from fat soluble to water soluble, excrete it in the bile. Bile drips into your small bowel, and then you excrete it through the stool. And that's where we use binders, clay, charcoal, cholestyramine, et cetera, which actually have a charge and they can grab onto that toxin in the bile, pull it out through the stool. So hydration through the kidneys, liver support is huge. Binders is huge. And those are really the core. And then we use other things, like you mentioned, hyperbaric. I love infrared sauna. PEMF mat can be helpful, all these other dry brushing, Epsom salt baths, because all of these things are helping your body to mobilize those toxins out of your tissues.
Excellent. Excellent. That's exactly what I would do as well. The one caveat that I would say is assuming you have left the environment, right? I mean, these things, certainly you can do them as people are trying to get out of the environment. So it sort of helps them tread water, so to speak, while they're still in the environment. But you're never going to make that traction until you actually get out of the environment. And then, yes, mycotoxins, for so many, myself included, are, I mean, frankly, really deadly. I mean, it is what, you know, moves to the autoimmunity. But I have been in moldy environments and have had patients that have that are not mycotoxin producers, and they have done more than just allergic reactions. So I don't know if you have experience in that as well. I mean, we are focusing on the mycotoxins because they really can be the really, truly the most deadly and immune stimulating. However, I have also seen molds that do not produce mycotoxins have really detrimental effects in people as well with their health. How about you?
So we have adaptive and innate immunity. Adaptive is the one in medical school. We were taught that mold could cause an allergy or congestion or asthma. And that's true, but that's not the deadly part of it. And then this whole innate immune system activation that can be activated by molds themselves or the mycotoxins they produce. And that's really what causes this cyclical cycle in our bodies that is keeps going and causes internal damage. It's almost like our immune system's inflammation can create damage even without, like, the mold could trigger that and then it keeps going.
Yeah.
It's this this perpetual cycle. So stopping that, you need to get out of the trigger. And you mentioned, I love that you mentioned that. I'll mention it again. You must get out of the exposure or get it down to such a minimal level, because otherwise it's like you're bailing out a boat that's taking on water and you're really not making progress. So you must get out of the exposure. You must really practice mold avoidance in order to get well during that time.
And have you found in your patients, I know personally and with many of my patients, once they were triggered by the mold, then the chemical sensitivity, you know, upticks. For others, it might be Wi-Fi or, you know, 5G or 4G sensitivity. Have you experienced these things as well, that it's like a switch turns on and then all these various other switches turn on as well?
Yes. And I think of that as bucket analogy. When you get mold exposure, it fills up your bucket very quickly. And it's a double whammy because it fills up your bucket so that you're drowning in toxic load, but it also turns off and uses up glutathione. So all of a sudden you're left without the resources you need most to empty that bucket. Your bucket's full and you're stuck. And I always feel like anyone with multiple chemical sensitivities just has a full bucket. So they're totally toxically overloaded. And as we bring that down over months to years time, that's when the patient will start to be less sensitive to chemicals as well.
Yes. Awesome. Well, we're going to be wrapping up soon. And what I'd like to do is kind of take a big circle back to where we started, which was your story with breast cancer. And here's your book and how you experienced in your healing journey the value of gratitude, friends, prayer, family. So can you talk to us about that in anyone's healing journey, and maybe a little bit about your book, Unexpected, as well?
Sure. Well, one of the cores here is, of course, I tell my story, but it really isn't about me. What I want is the reader to actually see themselves reflected, because we all have a journey. And whether it's financial difficulties, divorce, health issues, or loss of a loved one, or any other things I could name, we all are going through life, and life is hard. And we're either just getting through something difficult, we're in it right now, or it's coming up. Like, there's no other option. So when that happens, the resilience part of this book, and what the reason I wrote it, is how do we actually mentally, emotionally deal with the concept of difficulties and suffering? And if we can reframe that as teacher, like the stuff that you and I have been through, it's horrible. We wouldn't wish it on anyone, and we're hoping that we don't have to go through it again. But the truth is, it actually has framed and taught us so much and allowed us to go into the world and help other people. And when we view that kind of, again, we don't take away the suffering, but we can find meaning and purpose in it. It does transform. So at the core, whether you believe in God or not, or have a faith or not, the core of the faith and resilience is really about finding a deeper meaning and purpose, even despite difficulties and sufferings. And then the other thing that you've heard weaving through this interview that I think is so crucial is, so often, especially as women, we're told to be quiet, ignore our intuition, or all the other sorts of things, or we go to a doctor and they deny our symptoms. And one of my messages here is, women and men, but especially women, Your intuition is a gift inside of you that will guide you to the right answers and guide you to the right people and guide you to the right relationships and the right healing plans. And if you start to get back in touch with that, and you can only really get in touch with that if you love and appreciate yourself. So at the core of healing is this self-love and self-compassion and really trusting that voice inside of you that says something's not right. And then finding an advocate or support, family, friends, prayer, religion, not religion, whatever kind of thing, meaning your purpose, that gives you that sense of greater purpose and gives you that sense of understanding. And I feel like that's more important than any supplement, any IV, any hyperbaric chamber, is that really trusting our intuition, following it, letting us guide us, and loving ourselves at the root level. Those cores are more powerful than any pill.
Such an excellent message. I appreciate that so much. And before we part, I'm guessing that having your intuition is going to be one of your answers, but let me ask the question, which is, I always ask our guest, what are the first three things that you'd recommend our listeners do to take back their health?
Number one is sleep. I'm sure you've heard this before, but like, that's my superpower is I sleep well. I make sure and protect that and do everything in my power to get a good night's sleep because I know everything else is easier when I sleep. And some of you out there maybe have insomnia or struggling. Make that a priority because you can't heal and you can't process emotions and you can't trust your intuition if you're not sleeping. So that's number one. Number two is find that greater meaning or purpose. And again, for me, I have a faith of those, a bigger purpose in that way, but you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to have any sort of background like that. It can simply be a cause or a purpose or a reason that you are here on this earth. Because when we attach something greater than our meaning or purpose in our lives, it really gives us a reason to get up in the morning, a reason to do what we do, a reason to find a joy and meaning in friendships and relationships. So that meaning and purpose. And then lastly, this is three, but it's all in one. Go simple. You don't need to spend a lot of expensive money. I say clean air, clean water, clean food. Start with the basics, get those things in line. And I'd say that's 80% of the healing. Mm.
Excellent, excellent advice. I love each and every one of those. Well, could you tell our listeners where they can find you? I don't know if you're accepting new patients, but about your clinic.
Sure. Well, everything is on jillcarnahan.com. So just my name, JILLCARNAHAN.com. The book, the practice, we are accepting new patients. I have a nurse practitioner and a PA. That's been a long time coming though, because I've had a wait list and not accepting new patients, but we are now.
Awesome. I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah. And podcast and book and blogs, everything's there on my website.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This was such valuable information for all our listeners, and I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. And thank you for the work and the love and all the wonderful things you put out in the world as well.
I want to thank this week's guests for sharing their time and knowledge, and thank you for listening. To read the full show notes for each episode, which include a summary, timestamp, quotes, and any resources mentioned, please visit amymyersmd.com/podcast. Lastly, if you've enjoyed this episode, I'd love if you would leave a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and we'll select a few to read out loud in a future episode. Tune in next week to hear from another inspiring guest as we help you take back your health.